You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service. aboriginalpress.blogspot.com.
Dr. Paul, how confident were you at the time that the newsletters that bore your name represented your views on taxes, on monetary policy, the Second Amendment, the Tenth Amendment, all the things that you hold dear? How confident were you that the newsletter accurately portrayed your views on those things?
Well, the newsletters were written, you know, a long time ago, and I wrote a certain portion of them. I would write the economics. So a lot of what you just mentioned,
Was this while you're in Congress or between?
No, this was in between. It was an investment letter, but this would be material that I would turn in, and it would become part of the letter. But there were many times when I didn't edit the whole letter, and other things got put in, and then I didn't even really become aware of the details of that till many years later when somebody else called and said, "Did you know what was in it?" But these were sentences that were put in. I think it was a total of about 8 or 10 sentences, and it was bad stuff. It wasn't reflection of my views at all. So it got in the letter. I think it was terrible. I was tragic, and you know, and I had some responsibility for it because the name went out in my letter. But I was not an editor. I'm like a publisher, and if you think about publishers of newspapers, every once in a while, they get some pretty junky stuff in their newspapers, and they have to say this is not the sentiment and the position of that newspaper, and this is certainly the case. But, you know, I actually put a type of a newsletter out. It was a Freedom Report, investment newsletter, Survival Report, different ways. Every month since 1976. So this is probably 10 sentences out of, you know, 10,000 pages for all I know. But I think it's, you know, it's bad that it happened, but I have, you know, disavowed all these views. And people who know me best, the people in my district, have heard these stories for years and years, about it. And they knew they weren't reflection of anything I believed in, and it never hurt me politically. And right now, I think that is the same case too. I mean, people are desperate to find something.
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight for Indigenous rights.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Indian land! Indian land!
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. The white man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, "I took your land."
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for smart Aboriginal.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
I'm Mark Esterhazen. Fuck racism,
Fuck the pigs who killed Andres Tantane. Fuck the Avia beer. Fuck racism. We are all wild animals meant to live free. Fuck capitalism. Fuck fascism. Fuck this fucking wage slavery graveyard shit. Fuck domestication. Fuck Malema. Fuck the state. Fuck perpetual economic growth on a finite planet. This is the only fucking panic we have. If you don't agree with me, please see my blog, markestehazen.blogspot.com. Peace, love, respect, anarchy. Follow me on Twitter, Mark Estehazen. You can see me on Facebook as well, Mark Estehazen.
Internet Radio 3, Smart Original.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the fourth world from within occupied North America, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Salutan and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, the Angry Indian, editor-in-chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the fourth world from aboriginalpress.blogspot.com. And you have tuned in to Indigenous news, thought, and analyses concerning the issues that matter to original peoples and other communities across the world living under imperial, theological, racist, neoclassist, neocolonialist, neoliberal, and neo-fascist control. I wish you all welcome to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, welcome along. Shout out to the gods and earths and peace to the original family at this time of strife and struggle. This is your host, the Angry Indian, back for another episode of Original Afro-Indio Talk Radio. A lot of you have been asking me in the cafes, when am I going to make a definitive statement about Ron Paul? Okay, here it is. Ron Paul is a racist. There's not too much to argue about. You're taking smiling photographs with Don Black. You're a racist. You know, Don Black is an acknowledged neo-Nazi. You know, this is the same thing that happened when Sean Hannity was trying to disavow his connection to Hal Turner. You know, of course there's a connection to Hal Turner. You know, it's there. It's there. You know, but, you know, in the meantime, they're going to continue to talk about Bill Ayers, who, you know, was somebody back when, I'm not going to say he's a nobody, you know, he's in education and what have you. I mean, you've noticed that all of these white radicals have been able to go back. Well, not all of them, actually. That's not true. Marilyn Buck is still in there. There's quite a few people, the Weathermen, you know, the Weather Underground, that Ayers was the leader of, called co-leader, founder, what have you. You know, that ism that was going on back there, back then, in what was the 60s, right? What was the 60s? What it was. You know, I know there's a resurgence of that kind of thing going on right now, but it's not the same thing. This is a completely different, you know, ism. You know, it's a different world. And if you're going to deal with it, then you're going to have to, you know, go with not the flow, but have an idea of how the waves are going. You feel me? So, you know, here is the day. And again, I'm not a supporter of Barack Obama. Never have been. Read the material. The information is out there. You know, anyone that wants to assume, you know, especially Ron Paul supporters that want to, you know, assume that, you know, I'm a Democrat and I'm somehow supporting Barack Obama, or perhaps because I'm African, that I'm supporting Barack Obama because he's African. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. See, I'm conscious enough to understand that apartheid could not have gone on in South Africa if it wasn't the fact of the native Africans that were supporting the system. And not just the native Africans. You know, you had the imported help too, right? You know, Muammar Gaddafi, I'm sorry, you know, Mahatma Gandhi was a card-carrying member of the apartheid state. He actually formed a military unit of Indians, of expat Indians, that fought to defend apartheid in South Africa. He referred to Africans in Africa as Kaffirs. Now, we can, you know, you can look at the movie Gandhi with Ben Kingsley and say that, you know, this is the definitive Gandhi. But, yeah, I mean, you can say that. He was still supportive of the bias in Hinduism against the untouchable class. You know, who makes up the untouchable class? Dravidians. Black Indians, right? Where are they from? Do the research. Don't believe me. Do the research. East Africa, Dravidian. The Buddha You know, if you really want to get deep into it, what was the whole thing behind Buddhism? It came up out of the myriad of Hindu deities and what have you, what, 2,000 plus one deities? It came out of all of that. Supposedly, he came from a royal family. He came out of all of that. But what was the question? What was the question? You know, what was the whole thing about the untouchables? He's like, who the hell ever said that they can't attain some sort of mastery over themselves? That they can't attain some sort of fulfillment? That they can't attain Buddhahood? I don't accept that. And depending on who you ask, they will say that historically, the Buddha, I assume he existed, what have you. I know we're going on tangents, ladies and gentlemen, but, you know, follow me here with this. You know, because we're talking about bias, and we're talking about how bias is accepted. The Buddha did not accept racism. He did not accept racial bias. Now, yes, is there misogyny in Buddhism? For damn sure. You're damn straight is in there, you know. Ask any Buddhist nun if there isn't misogyny within the ism. There is. There is. It's a religion that doesn't have an afterlife. It's a religion that doesn't, if you're orthodox, as I am, that doesn't recognize a supreme deity or even an originating principle. You know, but then it turns around with all of the rest of the social justice that's involved, because the historical Buddha during his lifetime supposedly intervened in conflicts and tried to stop battles and actually wars, where he, you know, in a way threatened heads of state and heads of armies, saying that you'll have to kill me and my followers in order to continue this battle. You know, he would take mothers and widows and their children and what have you into the middle of battlefields to prevent the two sides from fighting. You know, if you're going to talk about Buddhism, let's really talk about it. You know, and I'm not trying to, you know, diss people who are into Tibetan Buddhism, but let's face facts. Tibetan Buddhism does not speak for all Buddhism. And when it comes to, you know, racism in Buddhism, we have to acknowledge that it exists. And we have to acknowledge, just like any other ism, it totally forgets its origins. If the Buddha is Siddhartha, if Gautama was the king of the Sakyas or prince of the Sakyas, he was a prince of the Sakya clan. They were supposed to be Dravid in Nepal. So you're talking about a person of color. And my teachers have always told me that he was a black man. That he was a black man from India. That is the way he was described to me. And again, depending on who you ask or who you read, you can go into this history and you can look and, you know, see who the Dravid people are, what their origins are. I've seen the DNA research on it. I don't believe there's any argument about this. And if we're going to talk about the Buddha, we have to talk about him within an African context. Because frankly, in the West, it's not even an Asian context. We tend to receive him through a Europocentric context. Through, well, Ibn Sa'id, I believe, put it best, Orientalism. You know, the otherness of that part of the world. You know, because, of course, Europe is the center of everything. And yeah, I went on a large tangent with that, and I apologize, but what I'm trying to get to is to separate the idea of racism, which is not an attitude, and this is something that we really, really need to be clear about. Racism is not an attitude. It is not a set of attitudes. It is a system. Racism. It is an ism. When you want to talk about actual attitudes, you're looking at ethnic bigotry. You're looking at religious bigotry. You're looking at nationalistic and regional bigotry, provincialism, what have you. Those are attitudes. You have a bias. But in the case of racism, racism is institutional. It is part of the system. And anyone that wants to argue that racism has not been a part of the legal system in the United States is totally ignoring Jim Crow. It's totally ignoring why the 14th Amendment was passed. Well, the 13th and 15th too, for that matter. It's completely ignoring the segregation laws in the United States. It's completely ignoring segregated housing, which still continues. segregated schooling, which still continues. Segregated prison facilities, which still continues. This is what's supposed to be the whole watershed moment about the Barack Obama election. The fact that an African, because I'm not going to say black, okay, that an African became president of the United States. And that somehow this paid the price for all of the lynchings, for all of the burned out towns like Rosewood and Black Wall Street in Oklahoma, that this pays currently for all of the black men that have been languishing in jail since the 50s and 60s for things that we know goddamn well that they didn't do. For the Black Panthers that are sitting in isolation, for having done nothing but be Black Panthers, pretty much. How many of the vice lords, once they became politicized, are still sitting in there, and we're not even thinking about them. You know, I mean, we finally got a step going with Mamiya, but you know, Leonard Peltier is still sitting in there, and what did he do? When you look at the court trial of Bob Robidoux and Dino Butler, how the hell can they hold Peltier? How? You know, I mean, what the hell is going on here? You know, so how the hell can you separate Ron Paul from what the hell he's attached to? And say that, you know, it doesn't make, you know, any sense to connect the two when they're still connecting Obama to heirs. When you look at Obama's politics, I mean, do you really think Goldman Sachs is going to give money to a Marxist? Huh? Do you really believe that, brother and sister, ladies and gentlemen, and and fascist lurkers that tune into this show? Do you really believe that? I'm very serious. Do you really believe that the capitalists at Goldman Sachs and all the other Blue Ribbon capitalist organizations that have given him money were doing so because they believe that he's a communist? Because they believe that he has socialist tendencies? Because they believe that he's a Muslim extremist that's trying to take everything from white people in the United States? Do you really believe that? If you do, you're a fool. He's done absolutely nothing but give to the security state, to the national security state, to the capitalist class, to racist white people. He's allowed them to call him all kinds of things, to insult his family, and he's done nothing about it. Well, he'll make a video in support of gay people, which again is necessary, and it was right. But you know, black folks need help too. You know, black folks need help as well. And we're not really asking you for a handout. You know, see, that's the argument of the Booker T. Washingtons out there that think Ron Paul is God. Because, I mean, they're so busy trying to, you know, crawl back to the goddamn plantation, it's unreal. But, I can't take them seriously. John McWhorter I can't take them seriously. I cannot take these Negroes seriously. I cannot take these Negroes seriously. Not when they're still talking about Bill Ayers. And here you have a photograph of Ron Paul and Don Black. And here you have Stormfront advocating for him. And I mean, what the hell? You know, David Duke has, since 2008 has been on the side of Ron Paul. And he doesn't reject any of their goddamn endorsements. And now Kelly Clarkson, you know, her album is selling great now, I understand, ever since she said that she likes Ron Paul, because it's acceptable to not like the black man. You know, so as long as you talk like a Nazi without actually looking like one, you'll get ahead politically. And if you think I'm kidding, look at what the hell is happening on the internet, across Twitter, on Facebook, about this whole thing about Ron Paul. They either say that they don't believe it, or they accept everything that the newsletter said. And, you know, that whole thing about responsibility in politics, how the hell is he going to be a responsible politician if he won't accept responsibility for what was printed in his own goddamn magazine that he made $1 million from? He made more than $1 million from this racist trash. And I'm going to tell you something else, ladies and gentlemen. I know for a fact that this material was intended for white races, because I remember reading the Ron Paul newsletter, or the Ron Paul report, because there were two that I saw under those two specific titles back in the 80s. Back in the mid to late 80s and up until the early 90s, I used to get packages from someone. And this is back in the old days before the internet, when activists actually used to have to photocopy everything and make copies and, you know, staple them, what have you, and, you know, get folders and send them out. And, you know, I used to work with, you know, groups like that. And then you had several others that were, you know, publishing information like this, most notably Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice. I think it's important to talk about this, because the skinhead movement, you know, began with Africans, with Jamaicans in England. And don't believe me, again, go do the goddamn research, because it's out there. There are ridiculous amounts of documentaries from the BBC, you know, from the 70s, showing the origins of the skinhead movement. Now, was there racism involved? Yeah. And see, and here's where I think it's important for African people, especially in the United States, to pay attention to this. Because the skinhead movement, according to the history, and there's a book by someone named Nick Knight that's out there. It gives information, but there's several other really good articles out there. And again, I advise people to do their independent research and to look up the anti-fascist movement in Europe. Because there's nothing like what's here, because there really isn't anything here. But in Europe, look up Antifa, look up the anti-fascist movement, the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee. They used to operate back in the day. And then you have Anti-Racist Action. I don't know if they're still around either. But, you know, check them out. And look up Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice. They popped around sometime in the 80s. And, you know, they basically organized and would collect, and photocopy neo-Nazi material that was floating around the punk scene at that time. And, you know, I used to get copies of this. The Nazi band Screwdriver, their stuff was in there. It was called Blood and Honor. And then there was the John Birch Society material. And then it was material from the Ku Klux Klan. And then there was the World Church of the Creator, you know, their stuff. And in that bunch, in another newspaper called Spotlight, and in that bunch was the Ron Paul newsletter. Now, I can't say I remember, you know, every article, because I don't, all right? You know, I'm not going to sit here and try to quote them verbatim, because I don't have to. They're on the internet. You know, like I said, in the editorial that we publish later, but there's going to be an editorial published about this, about what we're discussing here, you know, about Ron Paul, because people have been asking me, how come you haven't made a definitive statement? You write about fascism, how come you haven't talked about this? And it's like, well, I really expected to not say anything about this. But what changed my mind was Robert Scheer, the editor of truthout.org. I mean, I really respect him. And I can't understand how he can say, in his publication, well, you know, he wrote this stuff a long time ago, or he published it a long time ago, and it's not as important as his anti-war stance and big government stance and what have you. And I'm sorry, I disagree, and I find this to be somewhat hypocritical coming from someone with a Jewish mother. I just do, you know, because as a person of color, you know, how the hell can someone tell me not to worry about somebody that has neo-Nazi connections and to worry more about the government issue, you know, to really worry about everybody else's issue except mine? Now, you know, as far as I'm aware, and I don't remember actually reading anything specifically in his... I mean, it tended to be mostly anti-African, anti-black in his publication. I can never remember hearing him ever say, or anything written that was attributed to him, against Jews specifically. I have heard him make statements against Israel. But we all know that if you go to Rents.com, if you go to, you know, any of these far-right sites out here, you know, the idea of Israel and Jews is always a touchy thing, because they will talk about Palestinian rights only in terms of having Israel, you know, shoved aside, because they really don't like Jews. They don't give a damn about Palestinians. They don't like Arabs either. These are Judeophobes of the highest order, and what they do is they use people like Ron Paul, Ooh, I can't say that he is really Judeophobic or not. I don't really know. Like I said, I've never heard him make a definitive statement like that. But he has talked about the Israel as a political entity. And, you know, of course, this is part of their thing because they don't like Jews. So they will use that because it legitimizes them. And it's the same bit with all of this support that you see going on right now for Ron Paul. You know, it legitimizes white power. It legitimizes white supremacist attitudes. It legitimizes white bigotry. It legitimizes the Eurocentric argument that this land was given to white people by God, and that, you know, the Indians didn't deserve it, as Ayn Rand said, because they didn't know what to do with it. And we all know Ayn Rand was a goddamn phony because she died under a pseudonym, you know, on my goddamn tax dime. So, you know, the hell with all of that objectivist nonsense. And, you know, and the hell with Ron Paul's, you know, whole politic, because there's no difference. And he's an acolyte of Rand's. You know, I mean, there's no difference than the nonsense that she peddled. It's not serious. You know, if he had it his way, he would knock down all regulations, all civil rights laws, because he already said that he wouldn't have supported the civil rights bill. Any of them, actually, because we had two, which just goes to show you how the first one wasn't worth any goddamn thing, right? You had the Kerner Commission in, what, 68? And then they did it again 20 years later, and they said that the problem was still there, white racism. Look it up, Kerner Commission, you know? Look up the Church Commission and see how many Native American women were sterilized here. You know, no one was ever penalized for it. Nobody gives a damn. And Indians either don't know or don't care. You know, not as long as they think that somehow they're going to get something out of the system, which is all of the non-white support that you see going around for Ron Paul. Somehow these Negroes and these other apples out here seem to think that if Ron Paul gets in, it's just going to be this windfall. You know, it's the same kind of nonsense that went around in the African community with some of our sick and not very well-informed brothers and sisters who thought that when Obama got in, that somehow everything was just going to change, everything was going to turn over. Some of them actually expected a check, you know, which was a trip. But, you know, it turns out that the only checks that are being written are, you know, going to his campaign coffers and to his campaign supporters. You, on the other hand, brother and sister of whatever color, if you're not part of the 1%, you're not getting a shekel. But, you know, it probably doesn't really matter to you because you've caused to live through the fact that this man has become the leader of the United States. But it isn't really helping you, is it? Matter of fact, I can't think of anyone as helping other than the 1%. You know, and, you know, when you look at the hypocrisy about the complaints from the United States about Egypt and their violence, and Syria and their violence, and Russia and its violence, when you have, you know, women losing their children here from being kicked in the stomach during a protest, old ladies being maced, soldiers having their skulls fractured, soldiers, vets having their spleens destroyed, vets that are dying in custody. You know, it's like, how you gonna talk? How you gonna talk? You know, and I understand recently from today's news that Putin has actually pointed this out. How the hell are you gonna talk about us? What you got going on in your country? So, you know, the Michigas, the mayhem is worldwide. But, you know, in the United States, we know exactly what it is we're dealing with here, but nobody wants to discuss it. Nobody wants to really talk about it because, you know, white folks have to maintain their status. So if they can get it through Romney, they'll go to Romney, even though he's a hypocrite. And if they can get it through Gingrich, they'll go to Gingrich, who was a huge hypocrite. And have you seen his latest flip-flop? You know, first he's doing videos with Al Gore talking about global warming as a fact. Now he's denying global warming and saying he'll make Sarah Palin his energy minister. Can you imagine that? Sarah Palin, energy minister? Sarah Palin, you know, the woman who can see Russia from her balcony? Yeah. You know, the same Sarah Palin who attended a separatist conference. A separatist conference. You know, I mean, that's part of that whole neo-Nazi thing that's behind Ron Paul. You know, they want to separate and make a white America, a real white America. You know, to separate it off from the Mexicans and the Africans and the handful of natives that they figure still exist, right? You know, because every now and again, you got to get your dream catches and conchino dolls made by real Indians, right? So, you know, there's a few of us. And, you know, their figure that they can just have their little cut and they'll just, you know, divvy up everything else, you know, between the races. You know, like complete un-Americanism, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You know, I mean, David Duke has been pushing that kind of thing for more than, what, 20, 30 years? It doesn't matter. You know, Ron Paul believes in this hook, line, and sinker, and he doesn't have the cojones to admit it. You know, which I think is pretty embarrassing. If you're going to be president, you should at least have enough courage to admit that you're a bigot. But, you know, he looks like Woodrow Wilson to me. He sounds like Woodrow Wilson to me. And, you know, in the end, I think he's going to end up acting like Woodrow Wilson, you know, who told African people that he was going to look out for their rights and he was going to do all of this and he was going to be fair. And as soon as he got in the office, what did he do? He imposed Jim Crow on the federal government. It didn't exist before that. It was in the states, in the South, right? But he imposed it on the federal government and fired a hell of a lot of African people who had, you know, legitimately earned their jobs. But, you know, it didn't matter. Oh, he's also the cat that shall go down in African history in this country, for conscious people anyway, as the man, as the president, as the U.S. president who had the nerve to have a special showing at D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation. And remember, back then it was known as the Klansman, because that's what the film was about in the first goddamn place. Right? So, you know. I mean, he had the nerve to tell, who was it, William Monroe Trotter, that he should be glad that he imposed Jim Crow to keep the races separate? Because why would anybody ever want to mix? You should be, you know, appreciative of this. This is what he said to William Monroe Trotter. I mean, this is one of the most advanced black men in American history. So, you know, hey. You know, a little while after that, or around that time, you had the Palmer Raids, and J. Edgar Hoover and his husband founded the Bureau, and this, you know, went after Marcus Garvey, and went after the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, and went after the Socialist Workers Party, and went after the Communist Party USA, Communist Workers Party, and you know, American Indian Movement, I don't know, did they go after the Mattachine Society? Probably. Daughters of Bilitis? Probably. Kind of the way Hitler went after the brown shirts, Ernst Röhm, one of his good pals. You know, being in the closet, whether you're homosexual, whether you're a Nazi, it comes out. You can't hide forever. You just can't. You can't hide forever. It's impossible. At some point, the evil, the craziness, the insanity of it leaks out. And it usually spills out in a negative way, where people who don't deserve or want to be hurt end up on the chopping block because somebody else can't deal with their fears. And when we look at Ron Paul, we see white people who are so afraid of a African, Native American, and Latino backlash. Yeah, because, you know, they're not counting Asians, because they're the acceptable minority, right? Well, as long as you're female, right? They're so worried. Their nightmares have gotten them so much, especially with the election of Barack Obama, which, you know, they kind of didn't believe and probably voted for him, not thinking that anybody else would vote for him. That, you know, well, with the Electoral College, it doesn't really goddamn matter anyway, right? Your vote is complete nothing compared to that. It's bookish. I mean, their fears have gotten the best of them. It's gotten the best of them. And Ron, because of this, Ron Paul is surging in the polls, at least for a while. Newt Gingrich, well, he, you know, it's like a Bunsen burner. It goes up and down, right? You know, he comes in, you know, the more, you know, crazy he gets with his nonsense, especially what he recently said about federal judges who vote or decide against American exceptionalism. You know, if that's not a fascist statement, I don't know what the hell is. But, you know, you can go ahead through the looking glass and pretend that that's not what's happening here. You know, or Michelle Bachmann, who seems to think that African people in the United States had a better under slavery. I mean, it's in your face, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, and conservative lurkers. It's in your face. So you really need to make a decision. If, you know, do you want a better America? Do you want a better world, right? You know, where people are actually regarded as human beings, where there's respect paid to decency, where there's respect paid to democracy, where there's respect paid to paying attention to the lessons of the past, then I think you'll act accordingly and vote with your heart and start speaking out when you hear people say dumb, bigoted, and intolerant things. Now, on the other hand, if you're one of these suckers that likes to think that the United States has to rule, goddamn, by any means necessary, or what they used to call the Anglo-Saxon alliance, you know, the UK, Canada, United States, New Zealand, Australia, right? Auckland Islands, if you want to get technical, you know. I mean, if you really want to get into that, and we all see how Europe is breaking up, and how long ago did Yugoslavia go down? And we remember how that went, right? And who was behind that? Yeah. And we see the Euro breaking up, and there's all this stuff about gold happening. Yeah. So, you know, you have to ask yourselves, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, do you want to live under fascism? Do you want to, like, really, really go through the Orwellian nightmare, or do you not? Or do you not? You know, it's a very simple, simple question. I know, you know, a lot of people are tired of hearing me mention Sean Paul Sartre, but you know what? I don't give a damn, because I don't know anybody else that has put this with such, anyone else that has actually put this out with such clarity. Can a man condemn himself? Can the white man of the United States say to himself, you know what, this history has really, really been bad, and we need to cop on to the fact that, you know, because of genocide and slavery, this is how we got what we got. You know, until that can happen, this is what the Aboriginal News Group told the Occupy movement, until you can actually deal with that, brothers and sisters, until you can actually deal with that, you left-wing protesters, until you can deal with that, progressives, until you can deal with that, white American, there will be no progress. Until you can deal with the reality of how you came to be, since Jenneret seems to believe in invented Palestinians, there is nothing more invented than the American white man. So when you hear the American people, ask yourself, what the hell does that mean? Matter of fact, what does America mean? Read Jan Carew, Fulcrums of Change. This is The Angry Indian, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Mr. Malcolm, you have suggested that there are all kinds of movements in Harlem growing that you and I don't know about?
Oh, yes. Frustration itself has been sufficient, all that was necessary to make Negroes realize the importance of banding together. And Negroes are banding together.
Banding together in what kind of movements?
Different kinds of movements, all kinds of movements. And they remain almost invisible. They remain almost unknown. But yet they are there. When I say invisible, I mean invisible in the sense that their existence is unknown. And no matter how much you try and track them down, you can't find them. And never try and find them through the Negro leaders. The Negro leaders are famous as apologists. If you recall, one of the most famous Negro leaders in 1959 was asked by you about the Black Muslim movement. And he said he knew nothing about it. And the next moment, you flashed a picture on the screen with him shaking hands with me. So if you will recall. So this is their policy. This is their attitude or their reaction. They never know what's going on in the Negro community.
And what form will the activities of these various so-called invisible movements take in Harlem this summer?
An example, Commissioner Murphy. Almost every statement that Commissioner Murphy makes would give you the impression that he's encouraging the police, rank and file policemen, that to take whatever method or measures necessary to hold the Negroes in check. He feeds the type of statistics to the white public to make them think that Harlem is a complete criminal area, that everyone is prone toward violence. This gives the police the impression that they can then go and brutalize the Negroes or suppress the Negroes or even frighten the Negroes. Whenever something happens, 20 police cars converge on one area. This doesn't frighten Negroes. So it means that someone is either misinforming Commissioner Murphy and making him use tactics this year that he would not use 4 years ago, or that the former policeman Kennedy would not use. And this force that is so visible in the Harlem community creates a spirit of resentment in every Negro. They think they're living in a police state, and they become hostile toward the policeman. They think that the policeman is there to be against them rather than to protect them. And these thoughts, these prostrations, these apprehensions automatically are sufficient to make this make these Negroes begin to form means and ways to protect themselves in case the police themselves get too far out of line.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Este es aborigen inteligente de rato.
Internet radio for smart aboriginals.
Don't let the colonial occupation blues get you down. Listen to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The podcast for Intelligent Aboriginals.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Traditionally, Native women made all decisions regarding their reproductive health care. This was respected as women's business. Today, we are basically denied this decision-making power. It's time to take back that power of making decisions concerning our reproductive health. There is a choice we can make regarding unwanted pregnancy. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that must be taken within 72 hours after having unprotected sexual intercourse in order for it to be effective in preventing pregnancy. Contact your local Indian Health Service facility and ask if they carry Plan B. If not, tell them to order it. Plan B is an OTC, over-the-counter contraceptive, and a prescription is not necessary. You have a legal right to access this contraceptive over-the-counter. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Hello, I am Susan Aglukkaq. The North has the highest incidence of sexually transmitted diseases, STDs, in the country. We also have a high rate of teenage pregnancies. High-risk behaviors, unprotected sex, lead to the spread of HIV/AIDS. It can be prevented. Learn the ways to protect yourself and others. Knowledge is power.
Nothing British is a campaign against racism and extremism. Add your voice by signing our petition at www.nothingbritish.com.
This is Hayley Mills. We're all familiar with the issues. We all know that we should speak out, that we should take some responsibility for the disastrous decisions and actions made and taken in our name by the leaders of the United States of America and the United Kingdom. Ask your Congress member for the appropriate investigation into the activities of the current administration. Thank you.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
This is Kristen Hirsch from Throwing Muses, and you're listening to a podcast released under a Creative Commons license.
Free Leonard. It is mind-blowing for us to be here, now, at this late hour, with Leonard Peltier still in chains. Books have been written, documentaries have been produced, congressmen have joined his freedom campaign, all for naught. For Leonard Peltier, a former leader of the American Indian Movement, AIM, is still not free. That, to anyone with a soul, is a damn shame. Many Peltier supporters put their trust in a politician named Bill Clinton, who told them that when he got elected, he wouldn't forget about the Native American leader. Their trust, like those of so many others, was betrayed once Clinton gained the office and the FBI protested. In the waning days of his presidency, he issued pardons to folks like Mark Rich and other wealthy campaign contributors. Leonard Peltier was left in his chains. I won't restate the obvious. Leonard's innocence, the blatantly unfair trial, the crooked tricks that led to his extradition. Others may do that. What is needed is more support, not from two-faced politicians, but from the people, the many, who, like me and you, know injustice when we see it. Join the movement to free Leonard, Gwath Elas, or he who leads the people. Build it, for only a mass movement can bring freedom. Thank you. On the move, long live John Africa. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
White society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
Hey, what do you think about this idea? Since we freed the slaves in 1865, don't you think the black race owes the white race reparations? I was thinking like $20,000, you know, per person. I mean, anybody that's not on welfare.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
Intelligent radio for smart aboriginals.
Welcome to American Dream. I'm Cynthia McKinney, your host. And our topic today is U.S. racism in the age of Obama. Joining us in our studio, we have Marion Douglas Ungaro, an international human rights consultant. We have Dr. Jared Ball with us, from Morgan State, a professor at Morgan State University. And joining us by telephone from New York is Glenn Ford, co-editor of BlackAgendaReport.com. I would like to start off by talking about what some of our acceptable political pundits have to say about this topic. Let's hear what Bill Bennett said right after candidate Obama became president-elect Obama.
Does anyone know what this means in terms of change of race relations in the United States or a perception of?
Well, I'll tell you one thing it means. As a former Secretary of Education, you don't take any excuses anymore from anybody who says, yeah, the deck is stacked, I can't do anything, there's so much inbuilt this and that. There are always problems in a big society. But we have just, if this turns out to be the case, President Obama, we have just achieved an incredible milestone for which the world needs to have more respect for the United States than sometimes does.
The world should have more respect for the United States because we have President Obama now. Marion, what do you say about that?
Well, it certainly has gotten the world's attention, and I think the world has an impression, but I don't think the impression is really reflective of the reality.
Well, I mean, I simply say that this election was always arranged to be an international campaign designed to re-inscribe American imperialism as the safe, dominant entity in the world, improving to those who would question that even we can raise up, when qualified, we can raise up even one of our most oppressed and make him president, which, as Bennett was describing there, means that he will be used as the excuse or the exception that proves the rules of black inferiority, that even one of the more inferior members or groups of this society can rise to the level of presidency if you do and demonstrate that you are as remarkable as he has apparently to them. So
that's very interesting, and we're going to come back to that. Glenn, what are your thoughts about what Bill Bennett had to say?
Well, my reaction to Bill Bennett's quip when he states that Obama's election shows that we have accomplished something so tremendous is, what you mean we, white man? What Obama's election has caused whites in general, or corporate media in particular, and certainly right-wing white people like Bill Bennett, to conclude, is that it's all right for them to proclaim the beginning of some kind of age of race neutrality. And that actually translates as a negation of all specific black grievances. That is, black complaints are now considered illegitimate because, well, we've had that election. That is the watershed event. Y'all can just sit down and shut up from now on.
That's very interesting. And that brings us to our next point, because Bill Bennett went on to say this. Let's bring up our quote from Bill Bennett again. He says, Obama never brings race into it. Talk about the black community. He has taught the black community, you don't have to act like Jesse Jackson. You don't have to act like Al Sharpton. You can talk about the issues. Jared, what do you think about that comment?
Well, I mean, again, it's specifically designed to demonstrate the fact that if you are willing to be simultaneously called a member of the black community, the first black president, and willing to eschew a civil rights and human rights legacy, then you will be rewarded. And that is entirely the point by dismissing Sharpton and Jesse Jackson and, of course, all the others to which Obama would be connected, namely Dr. King or Malcolm X or many others, that if you are willing to separate yourself from that trajectory, from that tradition, then you can be at the same time a black president and dismiss the issue of race, which is
Marion.
Unbelievable.
Well, I am an amateur, I use that word advisedly, but I am a grassroots historian. I don't have a degree in history, but I have done a lot of historical work, research, background in journalism. And my father says I'm the griot of our family, the storyteller of our family and larger black American community. And Mr. Obama does not come from our population. That's the first thing. Well, just like I'm not Kenyan, and I'm not half Kenyan, and neither Mr. Obama nor myself is Ethiopian, Mr. Obama does not come from the black American population. Mr. Obama's mother was a white American whose family historically owned black Americans, were slave owners, and his father came on an airplane in the 20th century of his own free will from East Africa. My family, like yours, Jared's, and Glenn's, comes out of the people who were brought from Africa in the one of the largest forced migrations in human history to the Americas and to what is now the U.S. We've been here before there was a U.S., and we are racially mixed. But our families come out of the black people who were enslaved in this country. Mr. Obama is the exact opposite. He comes from a white slave-owning family, and his father's Kenyan. And that's actually, I think it's really an insult to our history.
So you think that that makes a difference in his outlook and then, of course, the policies that he might pursue?
He has not lived our lives, even his name. None of us, it's not a coincidence. Any most black people in the Americas, because we are part of the Afro-descended population of the Americas. We are part of a large group of people who were all brought by about 8 European countries that still exist today on slave ships. And Mr. Obama's family was not enslaved. They didn't have to live with the aftermath of slavery. His family benefited. They were white slave owners. They propagated children from black women without marriage. They sold those children, etc. They were involved in human breeding. And his outlook, I would like him to be honest, but he's never actually mentioned that. However, he did make a speech last year to the National Urban League saying that he opposes reparations, which I would substitute him with a person who is one of his counterparts, one of his cousins who's not half African, and who is also, just like himself, a slave owner descendant, and have this, that white person stand up and say the same thing in front of us. Would people accept that? He's against reparations when he is not part of the population that is owed reparations for our suffering and our history and continued suffering.
That's a very interesting point. Glenn, what do you
think? Two large results are there, related but distinct. One is how white people have interpreted it, and Bill Bennett probably is a good spokesman for that interpretation, and certainly that is a hostile interpretation. But the other is that it has caused internally a near collapse of black politics because of confusion, because of a variety of factors. But the end result is a collapse of black politics in the face of this new phenomenon. And when black politics in the United States collapses, that means progressive politics collapses. You know, progressive politics without us. And at the moment, we are basically inert. Now, there are many reasons for this. One is that people would like to claim a victory, even if the objective reality is that we have not achieved any great victory. But still, people would like one, and so they pretend that Barack Obama's politics are not what they are, what we actually see. So there's a kind of a delusional, a very curious, strange delusionism that we see in the black community. But the other is that folks are tired, and they don't want to struggle. But to paraphrase Frederick Douglass, if you expect a victory without struggle, it's like expecting rain without thunder and lightning. There can be no victory without struggle. And struggle means struggling against the powers that be, the powers of the state. And the state is run by a person named Barack Obama. And if we don't name him as our adversary in those cases in which he has presented himself in opposition to our broader goals of peace and justice and self-determination, then certainly we can't effectively struggle.
Well, now, this is a very interesting point, and something that I'd like particularly the audience to understand is that Bill Bennett is the former Secretary of Education, and Bill Bennett is able to express his opinions, like these opinions, on mainstream television in the United States. He's on CNN, which means he has an international audience, and he does this all of the time. But we have a distinguished panel of guests here who almost never have the opportunity to present their views, and thank goodness we have American Dream. I'd like for us to go to our next quote from the former secretary, just so we can remind people and let people know who Bill Bennett really is. The quote begins, "I do know that it's true that if you wanted to reduce crime, you could. If that were your sole purpose, you could abort every black baby in this country and your crime rate would go down." Now, Bill Bennett gets to sit as an expert on CNN, Fox, international news, national news reports. Jared, what do you think about this?
Well, I mean, you know, American media from its inception in this country was described, as early scholars in the field said, a fourth arm of the U.S. military. It is here to provide a specific militarized purpose and function in sustaining American hegemony in the world and maintaining order within the country itself. So it is no different than Pat Buchanan being given 2 weeks on the McLaughlin Group to specifically call for the assassination of Robert Mugabe with no adequate response, where black heads of state can be just, you know, called out for, targeted for assassination by people on national television. But more specifically, I think it goes back to the underlying concerns and needs of this country to elect a President Obama, the role of it as the singular empire, the damage it had sustained over 8 years of Bush,
the numerous times that it was mentioned in popular press that Barack Obama, because of this legacy that Marion is talking about, does not have the baggage of slavery, as they said, was the quote used often over and over again. So that there could be this idea that we would be able to, as I said a moment ago, raise up even the lowest among us to the highest levels, demonstrating the power and the forward thinking of this country at a time where, as Glenn alluded to a moment ago, the material conditions of black people in this country are in fact getting worse, and getting less attention today than it probably any time in certainly modern American history. So what we're seeing here is the use of popular imagery on a global scale to deny the kinds of gross inequality that maintain and are again worsening in this country, and at a time where Bill Bennett can get away with saying these types of things, where people like those of us convened here cannot have adequate access to raise certain important questions, and as Frank Wilderson has written, the power to raise the question is the most power, is indeed indicative of the greatest power to even raise certain questions. So we aren't even allowed to do that much in response to this kind of nonsense, and yet he is able to at the one time talk about connecting the death of black children to lower crime rates and talk about the wonders of the American nation at electing a black president that can overcome the racism. And we should also remember that Teddy Kennedy at the Democratic National Convention in fact said an election of Obama, quote, closes the door on discussions of race, gender, and even sexual orientation inequality in the country. So how election of a black man deals with all of that is in itself remarkable. But they were saying it quite up front, that the goal here is to close the door on these discussions, to make these discussions of racial inequality, white supremacist, capitalist abuse of black people in this country, render them moot. And they're succeeding to a great extent.
That fits right in with the next quote that we have from Dick Morris. Let's go directly to our quote. And what Dick Morris says is, by winning in a totally white state shows that racism is gone as a factor in American politics. Glenn, can you tell me, is that true? Is racism gone as a factor in U.S. politics?
Well, all we have to do is look in the prison where one out of every eight prisoners on the entire planet are African Americans. And we know, of course, that racism is not gone in the United States. In this current economic crisis, the black middle class, however it's measured, has been decimated and totally out of proportion to their numbers. That's because of what? Institutional racism in this country. But you know, when you have Pat Buchanan speaking against black interests, that's to be expected. They will always be with us. The only interesting aspect of that is that Pat Buchanan and his ilk are happy with Barack Obama's ascension. That should cause us some pause. But what is, of course, much more important is that was what Barack Obama does as president, and he affirms their belief that this new age of race neutrality, when black grievances are deemed illegitimate, has arrived. It is Obama who, at his 100th day press conference, when asked by a BET reporter about what was he going to do specifically about black unemployment, which historically has been at twice the level of white unemployment and is getting even higher in this crisis, when asked what he specifically was going to do about black unemployment, Obama bluntly told him in so many words, nothing. He said that a rising tide lifts all boats, which is a Reagan-esque kind of statement, signifying, no, I'm not going to do anything in particular for black America. And when Barack Obama boycotts and sabotages the Durbin Review on racism, which in fact is a continuation of Bush's policy on the Durbin process, well then, that creates an internal problem in the black community. It doesn't do anything to Pat Buchanan's hostile politics. They remain the same. But it
It creates a crisis for us because we, as a body politic, I'm talking about black folks, don't know how to respond to a black person who takes positions that are inimical to our interests. Glenn, that's where the crisis comes from.
Glenn, you've mentioned several issues that are extremely important, and I would like to take this opportunity to go to the State of the Dream report that was done by United for a Fair Economy, Enduring Disparities in Black and White. It was published in 2004. What they say is, in some areas, the racial gap has actually widened since the 1960s. In 9 African Americans can't find a job. Black unemployment is more than double the white rate. The typical black family has 60% as much income as a white family in 1968, but only 58% as much in 2002. Black infants are almost 2.5 times as likely as white infants to die before age 1. Worse than at the time of the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Jared, why don't you...
Well, these are the things that Obama's election are meant to speak against, that they are to deny, or they are to, worse than deny, suggest that if they are in fact true, if people even hear these statistics, which is not a given, they will couch it in the context of black inferiority. So I keep going back to what Du Bois said at the beginning of his book, Black Reconstruction. Read this either accepting black people as equal to any other group of humanity, recognizing that the conditions that they find themselves in is structural and the result of the system, or dismiss this book and everything else that I'm going to offer as useless because black people are naturally inferior. And again, so when I said at the beginning that I think Obama's election is meant to offer him up as the exception that proves the rule of black inferiority, this is what I'm talking about. Because even in his recent discussions of his statements in Cairo, where he spoke against, he said that the use of violence has had nothing positive, it had no positive impact on the movements of people in this country.
I remember that, and I was absolutely stunned.
It denies the kind of history, not to suggest that violence is whatever about violence, but it denies the kinds of history that leads people into struggle against the conditions that you just read about, and it denies the existence of the people who are still held as political prisoners fighting against these conditions that have again worsened since Dr. King, that links these political prisoners and the condition of black people almost accidentally in an appropriate way to the relationship this country has to Iran, North Korea, Palestinians, and others. That what should be understood is that black America does have the relationship to this country that this country has to the countries I just named and to the people that I just named. And we have to understand that Obama's election is not only misguiding and destroying internal black politics, but it's also denying the important history that connects our struggle to those of people around the world, which is again what one point was at the beginning about Obama's election being in fact an international one and having almost nothing to do with domestic American politics. So all of this, is I'm saying, is denies the history of Malcolm X, of Assata Shakur, of Matulu Shakur, who was still in prison, of even David Gilbert and many others who are still in prison for taking certain actions that were meant to strike at the heart of the structural inequality that you and Glenn have just described. And I think that this is causing greater, continuing to cause problems, because Glenn is correct that if, to the extent that black American politics are confused, so too will radical and progressive politics in general be in this country.
Marion, yeah. A rising tide lifts all boats, but if those are the statistics, then some boats have been left behind.
Well, you know, we used to be, black Americans historically were a rural agricultural population until the early 20th century. And at this point, within 10 years, there may not be any more black farmers in the United States. We are losing the land that we have had since slavery ended, and we've never gotten the amount of land that we actually are owed. So,
and 40 acres and a mule.
40 acres and a mule.
Glenn, we are about to take our break, but can you tell us very quickly what your opinion is of this? the fact that people don't even know that we have these kinds of living conditions and these kinds of statistics. In fact, we've got to go to our break now, and so I want you to put a pin in your thoughts. And when we come back after the news break, we'll begin with you, Glenn. Welcome back. This is American Dream, and I'm your host, Cynthia McKinney. Today, our topic is U.S. racism in the age of Obama. And joining us, we have Marion Douglas Angaro, an international human rights consultant, Dr. Jared Ball, a professor at Morgan State University. On the phone, Glenn Ford, co-editor of BlackAgendaReport.com, and also Diedrich Muhammad, who is the author of the United for Fair Economy reports that we've been referring to. Glenn, I promised you the opportunity to go first on those statistics that no one knows anything about.
When we have this discussion, and especially among black folks, we're always talking about Obama as the black president. And there's little discussion about whose president he actually is based upon his policies. This is the banker's president. Under Obama, mainly under Obama, some $12.8 trillion has been either given or lent or committed or otherwise directed to financial institutions. $12.8 trillion is 90% of the total gross domestic product of the United States in 2008. 90% of all the economic activity of the United States. That's been directed towards the banks. It's unprecedented in history. It's mind-boggling. But here is a president who directs these vast, almost unimaginable sums of money to his friends in the banking class, but tells the BET's reporter that he's not about to do anything about black unemployment. Well, why do we continue to call him the black president? Call him by his name. He's the banker's president.
Thank you so much, Glenn. This is a very good place for us to continue with our United for a Fair Economy 2004 report. It goes on to say that progress has been so slow that it would take centuries for African Americans to reach parity with white Americans, 581 years to close the per capita income gap. A black college graduate would earn $500,000 less, 150 years to close the poverty gap, 1,664 years to close the homeownership gap. One out of three African American males born today will be imprisoned during their lifetimes. But now, politics is supposed to solve these problems. Politics is supposed to deal with these issues. What is it that's going on with the black body politic? Jared?
Oh, well, I mean, I think a number of different things, suffering under the weight of all those conditions, number one, to begin with. I would argue that it also is a result of us living in the greatest degree of the most pervasive and the most pervasive media environment controlled by the fewest amount of people in world history is what we are subsumed within.
Seeing the kind of people who have access to the media.
That's right. So whether it's pundits on political television, whether it's popular culture, and particularly with hip-hop, all of these forms are carefully constructed to remove the substance and potential threatening power and results, resulting power that might come from that. So we have a community that is under a constant assault. So when Naomi Klein talks about her popular book, The Shock Doctrine, we have to understand that black America has been under a permanent shock doctrine. It has never ended and continues to increase and worsen to this day.
Diedrich, you wrote those words. You drew those conclusions. What is it with the black body politic? Are we able to deal with the facts that you have discovered in your research?
Well, clearly the black politic hasn't been willing to deal with those stats. And want to highlight, too, we even updated that report in 2008, a report called 40 Years Later, The Unrealized American Dream. And the fascinating thing about these numbers is that these numbers were during the good economic times. These numbers were before the worst, you know, recession in decades. And so... For the last 20, 30 years, been increasingly the way the body politic has wanted to deal with the social issues that African Americans have advanced in the past, or this economic inequality, mass incarceration. You know, there's a black Supreme Court judge. He just will do nothing to support and uplift the African American community. And so having a black in office, as long as they're disconnected and will not advance programs that will help deal with the socioeconomic inequality in this country, is perfectly acceptable and actually preferable to a good amount of the ruling class of our country.
Well, now that's a very interesting point for us to move to the 2007 United for a Fair Economy report that looked at the relationship between blacks and the Democratic Party. Here is what United for a Fair Economy wrote. For the last half century, African Americans have been the Democratic Party's best friends. While African Americans and Latinos voted blue, they still live in the red. Colorblind policies are not enough. A longer-term agenda specifically designed to close the racial economic gap will be needed to fulfill the dream of Dr. Martin Luther King. In 2008, the Democrats gave us Barack Obama. Is that enough, Diedrich?
I mean, it's clearly not enough, and you can look at, and Barack Obama, again, got about 95% of the black vote, but yet throughout the 2008 election, I never heard him once mention the fact that in one of the wealthiest countries in the world, a third of black children are living in poverty, and now it looks like under his leadership that a third of black children living in poverty is going to move to 50% of black America, of black children living in poverty, and it's not even being discussed. You know, there's so much discussion about the environmental crisis, the subprime crisis, the financial crisis, but it doesn't seem to be a crisis for African Americans to become even further alienated from the economic wealth of this country.
Glenn, what about the Congressional Black Caucus? Where's the Congressional Black Caucus?
Well, the Congressional Black Caucus has been in the process of deterioration, which you know on a very personal basis, for some time. The corporate penetration of the caucus has been accelerating since at least 2002, and it's part of this now prevailing corporate doctrine that black progress can be measured by the acceptance of black folks among white folks. So we now see, for example, that every congressman wants to be a senator, and every black congressman who wants to be a senator auditions for that statewide job by not acting like a black congressman. And so the ripple effect of this expansion of black aspiration has been to dilute the even those political positions that we do have. They become diluted because the office holders anticipate moving into a wider electoral environment. The influence of corporate money and the ideological invasion of a kind means that the black Congressional Black Caucus cannot be depended upon to be like black people themselves, the most progressive body in the U.S. Congress.
Marion, you worked on Capitol Hill. Where is the Congressional Black Caucus with respect to these statistics?
Well, I remember, Cynthia, when you were elected. Yes, I worked for Congressman Nate Major Owens, as you will recall. You and I went on a congressional delegation trip to Haiti together in 1993. I agree with what Glenn has just described in terms of the deterioration of the caucus. As long as the caucus is dominated by the Democratic Party, we're going to have this problem, or dominated by the Democratic Party and whatever few Republicans might also be elected, black Republicans. I'm looking at a broader international way of looking at this. Having worked in human rights in the Caribbean, South America, and in the Balkans, at this point I live in Italy as well as the United States. I met my husband in the Balkans. We were both working in post-Yugoslavia, and now I live in Rome also. But we have to look at our situation as a human rights situation and as an international one. We black Americans in the United States have to start to align ourselves with and get to know the rest of the Afro-descendant diaspora of the descendants of slaves, whether we are in Mexico or Brazil or Costa Rica, Trinidad, also our sisters and brothers, our cousins in the UK, which was the one that brought us here in the first place. There was no United States. And in France, where very interesting things are going on. They have a group called CM98, Committee for the March of 1998, March 23rd, 1998, which is an organization of the descendants of slaves. And they are doing some kinds of things that we're talking about. But we need to work in coordination. But black Americans and American Indians,
the Congressional Black Caucus?
Well, if they won't come along right now, they may come along later. But we have to elect more progressive people. And those of us, we happen to be with the Green Party, we want to see some more progressive people, not just Democrats, not just Republicans elected.
Jared, what do you think about the Congressional Black Caucus?
Well, as Glenn outlined, this is a tremendous problem. And we should note that overall, since 2006, the Democratic Party has gotten more from Wall Street funding than the Republican Party. So it has become as Glenn said, of Obama, the banker's party. So we have a tremendous problem in terms of our two-pronged political system that is intentionally designed to limit what Marion is talking about in terms of electing progressive politicians. What I think we also need is an outside the system, outside the nonprofit structure as well, social and political movement, one that recognizes these structural problems. Because again, King also said of his dream that it had become a nightmare by the end of his life. And that what he was also noting was that there needed to be something more along the lines of what we would call today socialism, not in the Barack Obama socialism for the rich, but a redistribution of wealth to communities of, who are in constant, and as the Economic Policy Institute says, permanent recession. We need the kinds of infusion of resources that were given to the very people that created this crisis over the past few months that Glenn also highlighted, to be given to people who are in these permanent recession situations. But that requires the kind of political movement, the kind of political electoral political campaigns that are not going to be allowed to occur within the established two-party system.
Diedrich, we have over 40 members of the Congressional Black Caucus. Is it the elimination of these racial disparities on their agenda, or shouldn't it be?
Well, they clearly should be. I would like to point out, though, that I think historically the best of black politics and social justice, has always come from those from social movements outside of the electoral political process. And then those in the electoral political process, those elected to office, were reacting to those movements. And I think we don't see as strong movements out there. And I think with that, we've seen that our elected officials have to become more and more a part of the establishment. But I think you're absolutely right. And I've talked to elected officials, and what amazes me is that they truly seem, I don't know if it's acting clueless about what needs to happen in order to improve these disparities, or if they truly are that ignorant of their own society's conditions and the kind of radical moves they need to push their party. And again, the Democrats got 95% of the black vote. We have a Democratic president who is African-American. We have a Democratic Congress. We have a Democratic Senate. And it seems like African-Americans are getting historically what they've gotten from either political party, and right now it's even barely talk. And it's something that I'm hoping that as the African American community in 2012 sees that yes, we had a black president, but we're in a worse condition now than we were after 8 years of Bush, will make many of us rethink how we engage electoral politics.
Interesting.
So now we are going to move to the commentary given to us by our people on the street about this issue. Interesting. So now we are going to move to the commentary given to us by our people on the street about this issue.
It depends on the case.
I guess race plays a factor in just about everything.
Yes. But things aren't over. So.
Yes, I do. I do think race is a significant factor in U.S. politics.
I don't think it's as much of a factor as it used to be. I think it's just people, no matter what race, color, creed, can do whatever.
Yeah, basically. But it's changing, and people are much more acceptable of other people, and I think it's getting better in the past 10 years.
Yes, I do.
Would you like to elaborate?
I think that everybody should have to go through American citizenship to become American citizens. I don't think we should be able to import everybody and have a free, just carte blanche.
I think it depends from person to person. It probably influences some people and how they view policies and candidates, and for others, maybe not. I think it's pretty individualized.
Absolutely, I think it is a factor in U.S. politics. I mean, just take a look at the presidential election just recently. And most recently, is the big deal about Sotomayor's even candidacy for the Supreme Court, you know? And, I mean, those two events alone should tell you that race plays a big role. And I'm sure there are people who did not vote for Barack Obama because he's a black man. Okay, and all the hubbub that's going on recently with Rush Limbaugh making all those comments about Sotomayor, etc. I mean, I think that it does play a big role.
Well, I think it's almost 100% there that race continues to be a factor in U.S. politics, and I'm actually surprised by the opinions that were expressed. But I would like to go a little bit further and ask, is the United States a racist country? But before I give you the opportunity to respond, I'd like you to look at this video.
Cynthia McKinney's question was, what happened with Oscar Grant? And what happened with me? And what's the community's response? For people that haven't been watching TV or didn't get in on the national news, Oscar Grant was riding the BART, the Bay Area subway, and he basically was pulled off the BART, accused of fighting on the BART by police officers, BART police officers, subway police officers, and subsequently shot. Alameda and BART officials, no one spoke on him being murdered in the media or anywhere else for 7 days, at least 7 days, and on the seventh day there was a number of protests. A local politician and clergy, Bay Area's activist community, but also grassroots people mixed with, you know, people from other cities that came in and different nationalities came in to protest the murder of Oscar Grant, which many people seen on TV that was taken from a number of different angles, from cell phones. January 7th was the first day of the Oakland Rebellions. There was three other days, 160 people was arrested in what is known as the Oakland 100 case. I'm one of the people who is facing a felony, a trumped up felony. I'm being accused of trying to burn up a trash can in front of the federal building, and it's totally bogus. The only evidence that they have that they're trying to use against me is a camera, in which I don't know how that would support a case of arson, but the camera proves that I was a journalist at work. So I'm still fighting a case, 150 out of 160 cases from the Oakland Rebellion. So 150 of them have been dropped. Four that I know of are being still charged as a felony. So I'm about to go to court. My next court date is June 24th. And I'm facing 3 years in prison for felony arson, as well as a strike. There have been a number of varied responses. Right now, as we record this, I'm at the Black Dot, the Prisoners of Conscience Committee, along with the Black Dot and the Village Bottoms community, otherwise known as the Lower Bottoms, for people who may have been from West Oakland before. We organizing right here with a lot of the black organizers that are working on the issue of Oscar Grant and also Lavelle Mixon. People who organize with nonprofits, there's a number of different coalitions with them. The Anarchist Guide, No Justice, No Bar. The Nation of Islam has meetings at Olivet Church in West Oakland. But there's a number of different people working on a number of different issues. Some of us are fighting it strictly in the community and looking for ways and entertaining ways to organize against it without the system. Some of us are looking at legal means. Some of us are looking at boycotts on BART and civil disobedience. Other people are looking at taking this to Sacramento and dealing with legislation. And you know how we getting this stuff out. You know, this coalition that I spoke of with Prisoners of Conscience Committee and the Black Dot and West Oakland in particular, but the black activist community, for lack of a better term. You know, we getting it out through a number of ways. We've been having town hall meetings at the Black Dot Cafe. We working on a film. I'm working on a film with Black Apes Production called Small Acts, Operation Small Acts, that's documenting everything that's going, that has been going on since the Oscar Grant rebellions. We also had a Black Report radio show providing information play-by-play to the hood about what's going on and different moves that people could be a part of that's being made. We have the SF Bayview newspaper, so some people need to see that kind of stuff in print. And, you know, it's a number of different people with Facebooks. Marcel Diallo got Facebook. I know Ademo, who got some stuff on police terrorism that's recently up on YouTube. Hairdo, it's a number of things going on right now. You can go to blockreportradio.com, sfbayview.com too. So, you know, make sure y'all check that out. Black Report Radio, Minister of Information, JR, POCC. We out.
JR reported that it took 7 days for the elected officials to say anything after the young man was shot and murdered by BART law enforcement. So we're coming up to the end of our show, of our allotted time. So I'm going to ask for closing thoughts. Is race still a factor in the U.S.? Marion, why don't you start?
It most definitely is. It's a global issue. It's not just in the United States. The United States is no different.
Jared?
Absolutely. Race is the determinant in this country, and as I would agree, around the world.
Diedrich?
Yeah, I mean, I think the election of President Obama reinforces how major a role race plays. The fact that President Obama felt like he could not highlight the economic alienation of his own community in order to become President of the United States.
Glenn?
As an overview, I think that white support for black demands probably peaked in 1965 and has been diminishing ever since, but that whites have become more acceptance of black individuals like athletes and movie stars and this kind of movie star-like president. But that the actual hostility to the race has increased. And that can be borne out by the black incarceration statistics.
You say the hostility to the race has increased?
Has increased, and I think the proof in that pudding is the statistics on mass black incarceration. If there is a bottom line, it is that that we can see that the number of black folks who have been taken off the street, whose liberty has been taken away, has multiplied and multiplied and multiplied over and over again since 1970. What does that mean? Well, obviously, that's the most dramatic manifestation of hostility to the race as a whole.
Glenn, you get the last word. Thank you all for joining us on American...
Under UTF Rep, you are listening to the Angry Indian Unintelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Talk radio for the fourth world.
When the Creator gave us this land to live on, there was no white man on this island. For he was across the ocean. That's where his patriot, not here in this land.
Hablar real para los pueblos originales. Está escuchando usted Radio Andino.
Honnête parler pendant les peuples originaires. Vous écoutez Radio Andino. Andino Radio.blogspot.com.
AngryIndianRadio.blogspot.com.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio. AngryIndianRadio.blogspot.com.